Welcome, my fellow investigators, to the realm where mysteries defy the constraints of mortality. Tonight, we will delve into the chilling world of true crime where justice knows no boundaries, not even death itself. Prepare yourself for this journey as we unveil two cases where the truth was unearthed from beyond the grave.
Good evening and welcome to Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot. I am your host, Winnie Schrader. Now tonight, I know I said that we were going to talk with an eyewitness to the Adam Walsh case, but schedules got conflicted, so we got to reschedule, but I will definitely get that episode out for you guys. Tonight, we're going to tackle two cases in our way, way back machine. One that happened right here in the good old United States, and the other one across the pond over in the UK. So we're going to start over across the pond.
Second left, exit, there's the hotel. Hey, look, kids, there's Big Ben, there's Parliament.
Have you ever heard of the Red Barn Murder? Well, if you haven't, you're about to. Born on July 24th, 1801, Maria Martin was the daughter of a Polstead mole catcher. What's a mole catcher? Well, I guess it's self-explanatory. His name was Thomas Martin, and his wife was named Grace. But when Maria was just 9 years old, her mother, Grace, passed away. So Maria had to take over her role as being the mom of the house, and she took it seriously. She was a highly intelligent little girl, though. She valued her education, so she refused to let anybody get in the way of that.
You go, girl.
Her father eventually remarried to a woman named Anne that took over the motherly duties so Maria could focus on her education. So when she was just 17, she got involved with a man named Thomas Corder. He was just the son of a wealthy farmer while she was just a poor daughter of a mole catcher. So he would sneak off to her cottage and, you know, apparently, they missed the birds and the bees talk because she became pregnant. Here's a shocker. He ended the relationship with Maria and abandoned her and her unborn child. Now, unfortunately, the baby didn't make it, but that didn't stop old Thomas from jumping up and down for joy like he was on an episode of the Maury Povich Show. Now, Maria licked her wounds and carried on. But she did spark up another torrid love affair, this time with a man named Peter Matthews. He was a highly respected gentleman in the community, and wealthy, too. Now, of course, like Mother Nature intended, she got pregnant again. This time it was a little boy. But Peter refused to put a ring on it, which did not make Maria happy. But at least he would send her money to help financially support her and their young son. Here Maria said she's a single mom again. She's a hopeless romantic. She just wants to find love. And who does she bump into? William Corder. Yes, that Corder. William was the younger brother of Thomas Corder. And William was known to be kind of a bad boy. Not that kind of bad boy. We're talking about a con artist who had forged checks and would steal people's livestock. He was even caught selling his father's pigs, which I guess apparently was highly illegal back then. Now, of course, like every spoiled rich kid's parents, they like to just smooth everything over with a couple Benjamins and a little slap on the wrist. God, some kids' parents, am I right? So William just kept on being a Chad, like usual. Now, we finally got caught red-handed. He got caught stealing pigs, again, with a fellow thief. But his daddy couldn't bail him out this time. So, like all spoiled rich kids' parents, and what they do is they'll just ship their kid off somewhere else so it's somebody else's problem. So he was exiled to London. Now, while William was over in London, his brother Thomas suddenly passed away. He accidentally fell through some ice while he was crossing a frozen pond. As a matter of fact, his dad and three brothers all died within 18 months of each other, so he was urged to come back home. At 22 years of age, William came back to Polstead. That's where he met a 24-year-old Maria. Of course, sparks flew and they fell in love. But William was a little hesitant, especially with her past relationships. I mean, she did have an affair with his older brother and got pregnant. Not to mention this whole rich-poor thing. Ugh, these star-crossed lovers. Though he wanted to keep her his dirty little secret. And yes, once again, history repeats itself. And she becomes pregnant. Again. Now, of course, William did promise to marry her once the baby came. But in 1827, when the baby was born, it only lived for a few weeks, and then it passed away. But William did promise Maria, despite losing their child, that he would still marry her. Now, William had a sense of urgency. He heard rumors that the police were on their way to arrest Maria for having three children out of wedlock. Apparently, that is a crime punishable by a public lashing.
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse.
On May 18th, 1827, William showed up to Maria's house, urging her that they had to leave, like, right now. She was worried that they were going to get spotted, so they had to come up with a plan. So William told her to dress in men's clothing to disguise herself as a man. He said he would dress up like a hobo to disguise himself, too. Jeez, what a looker. They had to pick a meeting spot, so they chose the Red Barn. That's where they would meet and change back into their normal attire. And they also agreed, before heading to Ipswich, that they would get married. So Maria started heading for the Red Barn, just outside of Barnfield Hill, about a half mile from Maria's home. That would be the last time Maria's family saw her alive. Now, Maria has been missing for some time, but her family wasn't really suspicious until William came back from Ipswich without her. Why would William come back without Maria? Well, his excuse was because they got married and he couldn't come back married to her because that would make his family furious with him. So, with everybody badgering him with questions, and for good reason, he decides to kind of go off the grid. Now, he did write to her family, but they're like, why wouldn't she just write a letter to us herself? Well, he would come up with excuse after excuse after excuse. She's unwell. She hurt her hand. She's washing her hair. Everyone was just eager to speak with Maria. They wanted answers. That's when Anne began having these dreams of Maria. Then she began to be plagued by these nightmares of Maria being murdered and then buried underneath some floorboards or something in a barn. She just couldn't take it anymore. So she asked her husband, Thomas, please, will you please go in there and check? So Thomas was finally convinced to go check it out, and like Anne wanted. And when he entered the barn expecting nothing out of the ordinary, he did spot an area of the barn that was kind of out of sorts. That's when he made the horrible discovery of a partially buried sack underneath some loose floorboards, where he tore open the sack and found his daughter Maria's decomposed body lying in the hole where she had been there for some time. Sister identified her by her clothing, hair, and her missing tooth that she had, but there was some evidence left behind by the killer. A green scarf that was wrapped around her neck. And that green hanky, kids, was owned by William Corder. Ding, 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 ding. So finally, after 11 months, William was finally caught. He was helping out running the boarding house with his new wife, Mary Moore, who he met through a Lonely Hearts ad. Oh, good Lord.
All right, my little army of darklings, you know that I would follow you into the gates of hell and beyond, holding your hand in proud battle. So I'm going to ask you to trust me on something. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by just about every overpriced wireless provider out there, if I've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, yeah, all right, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't a catch. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings on directly to you, my little darklings. I can tell you, making the switch has saved me hundreds of dollars, and that's no exaggeration. With all that we had going with our phones and the amount of phones that we had on our plan, it was insane. And every carrier was the same, overcharging, overpricing, and fees I wasn't expecting. So say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans and those jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with a high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered to you on the nation's largest 5G network. So now you know what I know and understand why we made a change in the Schrader home. It's time you do that as well. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. There is a $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plans. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions do apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
The police heard that William was there, so an officer, James Lee, went undercover to investigate. He went there with the ruse that he wanted to board his daughter there, so William let him right in. Once inside, James turned around and slapped the cuffs on William and told him what he was charged with. Of course, William denies having any knowledge of the crime. In fact, he says he's never even met a woman named Maria Martin. The police decided to search William's home, and they came across a bunch of letters written to William that they were warning him that a murder had occurred and a body was found. They also found a French passport, which told police that William was possibly going to flee. He was arrested and placed in jail in Suffolk, where he awaited trial. Now, with this juicy, salacious love affair, it was going to make its way across the headlines. The townsfolk were intrigued with this case. You had two star-crossed lovers, rags-to-riches type of story with the promise of marriage ending in murder. And the most intriguing part has yet to make its way to the courtroom. When the community found out that Maria was found because of her stepmother had a paranormal experience with some dream visitations, that Maria was dead underneath some floorboards in a barn somewhere, that intrigued everybody so much that it delayed the trial for several days. But it finally started on August 7th, 1828. People were flocking to the UK. People were dying to get a front row seat at this trial. They had to give out tickets to people because they could only let so many people in the courtroom. William had 9 counts against him, including forgery, strangulation, shooting, and a stabbing. Finally, Anne Martin was called to testify that she knew of the plan for Maria and William to meet up at the Red Barn. And finally, she went into the dreams that she was having. She told the court that she repeatedly kept having these nightmares of seeing Maria's body underneath these loose floorboards in a barn with a red roof. so it had to be the Red Barn, right?
Now, William admitted to being in the barn with Maria, but they said they got in an argument and he left. He claims he was walking away from the barn when he heard a gunshot, so he said he ran back into the barn where he saw Maria laying dead on the floor with a pistol laying next to her on the ground. He said he panicked and just buried her underneath the floorboards of the barn. But he never gave reason as to why he tied the green scarf around her neck. And in true narcissistic fashion, he blamed the press for ruining his reputation. I hate to break it to you, but you kind of do that well on your own. Prosecution rests this case, and now William's life hangs in the balance. Though it only took 35 minutes for the jury to come back and say he was guilty. William was sentenced to death and was brought back to prison where he awaited execution. William was sentenced to death and was brought back to prison where he awaited his execution, still denying that he was guilty of stabbing Maria. How it took just a few days for that egg to finally crack. He did confess to a prison chaplain that he accidentally shot Maria in the eye after an argument. On August 11, 1828, William was brought to the gallows for his execution. Now, there was a huge crowd, and I mean huge for that time. Just before they pulled the hood over his head, he said his last words, "I am guilty, my sentence is just, and I deserve my fate, and may God have mercy on my soul." It's funny how almost 200 years ago, such a sensationalized court case like the ones we have today, Depp versus Heard, so much so, like, during the trial, they had local plays going on that were about the murder of Maria Martin. So much so, it was like a made-for-TV movie on Lifetime. One of the even weirder things about this is that after he died, they took his body and dissected him and studied him, and they have his bones now on display at the Suffolk Museum. Now let's just hope they don't do it with this guy. And the cherry on this murder Sunday is the simple fact that he was convicted on a paranormal experience where Maria's stepmother had a dream visitation, reoccurring nightmares of Maria being murdered and placed in the floorboards of this barn. Talk about true crime with a paranormal twist. Which is going to lead us into our next case. They needed a little help beyond the veil to solve this game of Clue. Arizona Hester was a young woman living in Greenbrier County in West Virginia in the late 1800s. Everyone called her Zona, but she was known for her beauty and her kindness and her vivacious spirit. But her life took a dark turn when she married a man named Erasmus Shue, a.k.a. Trout. He was a blacksmith with a troubled past. Their marriage seemed idyllic at first, you know, the whole honeymoon thing. And they settled into a nice farmhouse in Greenbrier County. But there were whispers of Trout's possessiveness and jealousy, which began to spread throughout the small community. Then in January 1897, tragedy struck, and Zona was found dead in her home under mysterious circumstances. Now, the local doctor initially attributed Zona's death to be an everlasting faint, a term used to describe fainting spells or sudden death with no apparent cause. But Zona's mother, Mary Jane Hester, she was convinced that something more sinister had occurred. Mary Jane claimed that her daughter's ghost appeared to her on multiple occasions, revealing that she had been murdered by her husband, Trout, that Trout had broken her neck in a fit of rage. So Mary Jane went to the authorities with this information, and of course, they were very skeptical of it. They exhumed Zona's body and performed an autopsy, which revealed evidence of a broken neck and signs of strangulation. Trout Shue was arrested and charged with the murder, making it the first time in American history that ghostly testimony was used in evidence in a court case.
I wonder what that testimony sounded like.
"Now, Miss Hester, I've heard that you had some dream or vision which led to this post-mortem examination.
It was no dream. She came back and told me that he was mad that she didn't have no meat cooked for supper. But she said that she had plenty and said that she had butter and apple butter. Apples and named over two or three kinds of jellies, pears, cherries, and raspberry jelly. And she said I had plenty. And she said, don't you think that he was mad and just took down all my nice things and packed them away and just ruined them? And she told me where I could look down back at Aunt Martha Jones in the meadow in a rocky place, that I could look in a cellar behind some loose plank and see. And it was a square log house. It was hewed up to the square. And she said for me to look right at the right-hand side of the door, and as you go in, at the right-hand corner as you go in. Well, I saw the place just exactly as she told me, and I saw the blood right there where she told me. And she told me something about that meat every night she came, just as she did the first night. She came four times, four nights. But the second night, she told me that her neck was squeezed off at the first joint, and it was just as she told me.
Now, Miss Easter, this sad affair was very particularly impressed upon your mind, and there was not a moment during your waking hours that you did not dwell upon it, correct?
No, sir, and there is not yet either.
And was this not a dream founded upon your distressed condition of mind?
No, sir, it was no dream. For I was wide awake as I ever was.
Then, if not a dream or dreams, what do you call it?
I prayed to the Lord that she might come back and tell me what happened. And I prayed that she might come herself and tell on him.
Now, do you think that you actually saw her in the flesh and blood?
Yes, sir, I do. I told them the very dress that she was killed in, and she went to leave. She turned her head completely around and looked at me. She wanted me to know all about it. And the very next time she came back to me, she told me all about it. The first time she ever came, she seemed like she did not want to tell me as much about it as she did afterwards. The last night she was there, though, she told me that she did everything she could, and I'm satisfied that she did all that, too.
Now, Mrs. Easter, don't you know that these visions, as you term them or describe them, were nothing more or less than four dreams founded upon your distress?
No, I don't know it. The Lord sent her to me to tell it. I was the only friend that she knew she could tell and put any confidence in it. I was the nearest one to her. He gave me a ring that he pretended she wanted to have, but I don't know what dead woman he might have taken that off of. I wanted her own ring, and he would not let me have it.
Mrs. Easter, are you positively sure that these are not four dreams?
Yes, sir. It was not a dream. I don't dream when I'm wide awake, and to be sure, I know what I saw, her right there with me.
Are you not considerably superstitious?
No, sir. I'm not. And I was never that way before, and I'm not that way now.
Do you believe the scriptures?
Yes, sir, and I have no reason not to believe it.
And do you believe that the scriptures contain the words of God and his Son?
Yes, sir, I do. Don't you believe it?
Now, I would like, if I could, to get you to say that those were four dreams, not four visions or appearances of your daughter in the flossy flesh and blood.
And I am not going to say that, for I am not going to lie.
Then you insist that she actually appeared in flesh and blood to you upon four different occasions.
Yes, sir.
Did she not have any other conversation with you other than that upon the matter of her death?
Yes, sir. Some other little things. Some things I had forgotten. Just a few words. I just wanted the particulars about her death, and I got them.
When she came, did you touch her?
Yes, sir. I got up on my elbows, and I reached out a little further, as I wanted to see if people came in the coffins. And I sat up and leaned on my elbows, and there was a light in the house. It was not a lamplight. I just wanted to see if there was a coffin, but there was not. She was just like she was when she left this world, It was just after I went to bed, and I wanted her to come and talk to me, and she did. This was before the inquest, and I told my neighbors. They said that she was exactly as I told them she was.
There was no witness to the crime charged against Defendant Hsu, and the state rests its case for conviction wholly upon circumstances connecting the accused with the murder charge. So the connection of the accused with the crime depends entirely upon the strength of the circumstantial evidence introduced by the state. There is no middle ground for you, the jury, to take. The verdict inevitably and logically must be for murder in the first degree or in acquittal.
So Trout lived out the rest of his years behind bars, but at least we know he made good use of his time. Don't you just love Art Day? Now, of course, this case was on the precipice of the spiritualism movement, which I'm sure gave that train ride a lot of steam. Zona could finally rest in peace, knowing that her killer was brought to justice. And the legend of the Greenbrier ghost still lives on to this day. Cliff note, now I know it says Edward on the sign, but he had like two first names and a nickname, so I just picked one. Now the case of the Greenbrier ghost and the Red Barn ghost are a fascinating and chilling example of how the intersection between crime and superstition and the supernatural, and how it could just continues to captivate the imaginations of people around the world, reminding us that sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction.
Thank you for listening to Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot. I am your host, Wendy Schrader, and until our next case, my fellow armchair detectives, stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay aware. We'll see you next week, right here on Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot.